Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with last Friday's explosive court filings by Robert Mueller and focus on the special counsel's memo to a federal judge revealing that Paul Manafort had told, quote, multiple discernible lies to investigators in the special counsel's office about his contacts with Trump administration officials, his interactions with his deputy, a suspected Russian military intelligence officer, Konstantin Kalimnik, and an unnamed top Russian official offering synergy between the Trump campaign and the Kremlin. Anders Asland, a professor at the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and European Studies at Georgetown University, who was a former Swedish diplomat in Moscow and served as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia and Ukraine, joins us. We will discuss the heavily redacted court filing on Manafort and who the unnamed Kremlin official offering synergy is, as well as the increasing likelihood that in spite of President Trump's ritual insistence that there was no collusion between him and his campaign and the Russians, it appears that Mueller has put together the broader mosaic of conspiratorial ties between Trump and the Kremlin, which Manafort recklessly and brazenly lied about. We'll speculate why Manafort risked decades in prison to break his agreement with Mueller and why he lied to cover up the involvement of his deputy, Kalimnik, and his contacts with someone who was probably either Putin's spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, or Putin's former chief of staff, Sergei Ivanov. Then we will speak with an expert on the French Socialist Party, European social democracy, and French politics, Philippe Malliere, a professor of French and European politics at University College London, about the weeks-long riots in France led by the Yellow Vest movement, which have devastated the French economy and paralyzed the government of Emmanuel Macron, who has had to back down on a fuel tax, which sparked the riots, and the repeal of a tax on the super rich. We will assess whether, at the end of the day, with the political center collapsing and the left more irrelevant than ever, the far right will be the beneficiary of this grassroots nonpartisan uprising. Then finally, with Saudi Arabia, along with the US and Russia, blocking the release of the latest global report on global warming and revelations that Jared Kushner secretly advised MBS, the Saudi Crown Prince, on how to deal with the fallout from the assassination of the Washington Post journalist, who the whole world, with the exception of Donald Trump, believes was murdered and dismembered on orders from MBS, we'll investigate the role of the Saudi monarchy in exporting political violence around the world. Terence Ward, an author and documentary filmmaker who grew up in Saudi Arabia and is the author of the new book just out, The Wahhabi Code, How the Saudis Spread Extremism Globally, joins us. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Anders Asland, a professor at the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, a member of the Russian Academy of Natural Sciences. He worked as a Swedish diplomat in Kuwait, Poland, Geneva, and Moscow and served as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia and Ukraine. And his books include Russia's Capitalist Revolution, Why Market Reform Succeeded and Democracy Failed, and Ukraine, What Went Wrong and How to Fix It. And his latest book is Europe's Growth Challenge. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anders Asland.
Thank you.
So, Anders, what did you make of this filing to the federal judge about Manafort, which was dropped on Friday, along with other court filings, in particularly the one in the Southern District of New York, which has gotten a lot of attention because it essentially reveals that from Michael Cohen's testimony, basically implicating the president in crimes, in fact, felonies involving in campaign finance violations. That's gotten a lot of attention. But it seems to me that the filing relating to Manafort, which was pretty thin but and heavily redacted, but I thought it was probably the most explosive of all that was revealed last Friday. How did it strike you?
the first point is that we see that Robert Mueller has a lot of knowledge that obviously Manafort and President Trump did not know that he had, so that he can say that these are lies. And we can also see that there are many more connections with Russia, and they're earlier, and they go higher up than we knew before from all three of these different statements, the two Cohen statements and the Manafort statement from Friday. So, to my mind, President Trump is cooked now, as you said. There is implication of two felonies in these documents, and individual one is pretty clearly identified, since it says that he went on to successfully pursue a presidential campaign. So I'm a bit surprised that Trump and leading GOP representatives don't understand that this is so substantial. And we're also seeing consistently how Robert Mueller operates, that he has one building stone after the other. And clearly there are several more big building stones that are about to come, but when, we don't know.
And Anders Asselin, you knew Paul Manafort when he was working for the Ukrainian government of Yanukovych, which was essentially a puppet government of Putin's. And I remember in a prior conversation we had where you said that there's no way in the world that Paul Manafort, who was completely in charge of the media for the election of Yanukovych, he was also in charge of the Russian language media, which was beamed into the eastern part of Ukraine, which is rather pro-Russian, that would never have happened but for Manafort's having close ties to the Kremlin. So how deeply do you think that the Kremlin owned Manafort, and how much did his deputy in Ukraine, the alleged GRU officer, Konstantin Kalimnik, how important was his role?
I think that is very important, and it seems that Manafort has cooperated directly with GRU. There is an unverified but strong rumor that Manafort had regular meetings in Kiev when he operated there, together with a group of GRU officers, Russian military officers, intelligence officers, together with Kilimnik, and that people like Rick Gates were not allowed into these meetings, and they controlled the Russian television coverage, which was decisive for half the Ukrainian population. And also we have that Manafort traveled at least 18 times to Moscow while working in Kiev, so he was regular in Moscow. We know that he had regular contacts with Oleg Deripaska. Yesterday, Telegraph, the British newspaper, published that Deripaska's CEO for EN Plus, his holding company, Yevgeny Fokin, that he is a senior GRU officer. So one of the accusations against Deripaska has been that he was deeply involved in GRU. So we see here a massive involvement with Russian intelligence, and also that WikiLeaks and Assange, it has been long been rumored that they are about to be indicted together with Roger Stone. And all of this goes back to Manafort. And as you pointed out, in this very heavily redacted statement, there are implications that Manafort has been involved in this.
So how comprehensive do you think is the mosaic that Manafort has? We're only seeing little pieces of the mosaic from these court filings. But I take it it's your feeling that the broader picture, he's got a handle on the big picture, and that this is when it's revealed to the American people. My assumption would be that it would be devastating. And that's why the president keeps talking about no collusion, no collusion, because that is what he's afraid of. The way that he will lose his base that are in the kind of bubble of Fox News that are impervious to evidence and facts. The one thing that might get through to Trump's base of support is the idea that Trump did, in fact, collude with a hostile foreign power. And that may be the straw that breaks the camel's back in terms of Trump's core support.
Indeed, I think that the two big, two other big conclusions from these recent statements is first that there were many more direct contacts with high-up Russians, and secondly, that then-candidate Trump was all the time briefed about it, so he can't stay out of it any longer. This is really the first time that we see that Trump was in conversation with them all the time. And also this, as you mentioned, that it seems to have gone up to Putin's press spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, that we have heard before, and also that Michael Cohen had another channel, which is presumed to be Sergei Ivanov, then Putin's chief of staff. And this is the very highest level around Putin. So now it's no longer the Azerbaijani Russian oligarch Aras Agalarov, who was the intermediary, but much higher people. So these statements that came out this week are really far more damning in terms of the seriousness of actual collusion with senior Russian officials than what we have seen before. What we don't see from these statements is that it has been successful, and we don't see that there is Russian money going into Trump's or the Trump organization's cashier. So this is a big thing that we're waiting for.
And again, I'm speaking with Anders Aslan, who's a professor at the Center for Eurasian, Russian and East European Studies at Georgetown University, a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, a member of the Russian Academy of Natural Sciences. He worked as a Swedish diplomat in Moscow and serves as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia and Ukraine. And his latest book is Europe's Growth Challenge. So do we know then why Manafort was chosen by Trump? Could it have been that the Russians basically essentially suggested that Trump appoint Manafort?
The suspicion lingers among Russian liberals who are always good at conspiracy theories, and it's quite possible. Also, think of it, Manafort was very much the Republican establishment. I remember hearing Chris Wallace when he was in 2016, when Manafort was appointed, and said, "Oh, Manafort, we all know Manafort for decades." So he was, of course, very convenient when Trump wanted to get more Republican establishment people. And frankly, I think that Paul Manafort, by his record, to have Yanukovych elected four times, such an awful candidate, that he is probably just about the best and most ruthless political advisor in the world. Nobody could have succeeded in getting Yanukovych elected apart from Manafort.
Well, but the fact that he got him elected, what seems to be more incriminating, at least in the court of human rights, if you will, is that towards the end, when the people in Ukraine rose up against Yanukovych and they were shot down by his secret police, that I believe that Manafort was actually there in the palace with Yanukovych, who was under siege, advising him. So to that extent, you could make the case that Manafort has blood on his hands.
It's very likely that that is the case. I have not seen any clear evidence on it, but the suspicion is that he was there, and Manafort is not the person who suggests that one should go soft. He's a true hardliner when it comes to winning.
So given that this, we can see from these court filings where Mueller is heading and get a glimpse of how much he knows. As you pointed out, he knows an awful lot more. And now the Trump administration and Trump himself has to know that Manafort has an awful lot of information. Because as you pointed out, Anders Aslan, you have to know what the lie is about in order to make the accusation that somebody lied.
Indeed. I think that Mueller has a lot. And if I were in Trump's place, I would really freak out now. But it doesn't seem as if he thinks that this is serious. He thinks that he can talk it away, that he just shouts louder and thinks that that will help. And, of course, that is positive if we don't see any more desperate actions from President Trump.
Well, that would lead one to ask, one, is President Trump delusional and in an alternative universe? Because he does seem to have a very difficult time discerning what is true and what is not true. Or two, does he have some plans to shut down Mueller? What do you think?
I think that is delusional. And also one wonders about his health here. A lot of noise is being made that he needs to take a motorcade to move 250 yards. Perhaps he can't walk that much any longer. It's clear that he is struggling sometimes when he's just standing. In the cathedral for the George H.W. Bush funeral, people often complain about his bad behavior. Perhaps he's simply in a state of dementia, so that he's not quite able to manage himself. Perhaps we should look upon him as a medical case rather than as only a person who pursues obvious crimes.
Well, Anders Aslan, you've given us a lot to think about, and I appreciate your joining us.
Thank you very much, Ian. Always nice to talk to you.
Thank you again. I've been speaking with Anders Aslan, who's a professor at the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, a member of the Russian Academy of Natural Sciences. He worked as a Swedish diplomat in Moscow and served as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia and Ukraine. And his books include Russia's Capitalist Revolution, Why Market Reform Succeeded and Democracy Failed, and Ukraine, What Went Wrong and How to Fix It. And his latest book is Europe's Growth Challenge. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back speaking about the riots continuing in France, the so-called Yellow Vest Movement.
Come with me and you'll be in a world of pure imagination. Take a look and you'll see into your imagination. We'll begin with a spin, traveling in the world of my creation.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Philippe Mallier, who's a professor of French and European politics at the University College of London. He was awarded the Marcel Liebman Chair in Political Science by the Université Libre de Bruxelles, and his main publications are about the French Socialist Party, French politics, and European social democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Philippe Mallier.
Hello there.
And Philippe, France is burning. That is not an exaggeration. And these Yellow Vest riots have been extraordinary and continuing. The police seem to have come up with some new tactics to perhaps contain it more. But the political damage done to Macron appears to be pretty severe, if not lasting. How do you see it?
I agree with your assessment in general. I think it's, of course, it's needless to say it's taken everyone by surprise. No one saw it coming. You know, it's started over 3 weeks ago. Initially, we know the story. It was a sort of protest against a tax on diesel fuel. And it was essentially, you know, people in the countryside blocking, you know, roads, roundabouts. And that was essentially that. But, of course, it now has spread to other areas, and I think it also has gained momentum because now there seems to be a kind of a ritual. Every Saturday, people converge to big cities, notably Paris, where they take to the streets. And I think, yes, there have been scenes of very radical protest, including violence. But I should say, you know, violence is always something you have to look into very carefully. I think there's been also a lot of police brutality and a lot of questions being raised also around how the French police has been managing those largely peaceful protests. But it is true that the first political consequence of those actions, again, which are not, run or decided by any political organization. It's really something which is out of the blue, but very political, very politicized. That's the paradox. So it is fair to say that it has seriously challenged Emmanuel Macron's, the French president's, authority. I think Macron has been very slow to react to it. It took him almost 3 weeks to come forward, and even when he did it, first of all, he did not acknowledge that those protesters had a point. It's only recently that he's decided finally first to suspend and then to ditch, to scrap that tax on fuel. So perhaps too little and too late, because as I speak, you know, the movement is still on. I think next week we'll have a fifth week of protest across France. It is very serious, really. I can't remember a scenes of protest as big and as important as those we are witnessing across France today. As you know, a long time ago, you probably have to go back to May 68.
Well, it does seem, though, that the deeper issues here are a sense that most of France feels that they haven't benefited. And you had a centre-right government form out of nowhere. The failure of the long-serving socialists, I think, can't be ignored in this context. And suddenly it seems like this new centre-right coalition that came out of nowhere that put Macron in power, it's just now under attack. And isn't this really the angst and the anxiety of the majority of the French people, that they feel that this government only takes care of the rich? They repealed taxes on the super rich. Then they taxed the ordinary people by charging them more for gasoline. That, to my mind, seems to be at the heart of it. The people basically saying, we want a piece of the pie.
Yes, absolutely. It's very clear that, you know, what people protest against is the sort of unfair taxation. They're not against tax as such. This is really, you know, the French normally accept the need for taxation. You know, they will also want very good public services, and they know that there's a price for that. So I don't think it's against taxation as such, but it's about unfair taxation. One of the first measures taken by Macron when he was elected over a year ago was to scrap the so-called wealth tax, that is, the tax paid by the sort of richest 5% of the population, millionaires, if you like. He did that. It's always, you know, a very unwelcome and unpopular move. That to remember that we need to remember that the first president ever to set up this kind of tax was François Mitterrand in 1981, the then socialist president. So every time a government, and I think so far it's been a conservative government, has scrapped that wealth tax, you know, it hasn't gone down well with the public. So he did that. And then, of course, now he sort of taxes, or he wanted to tax, because it's been scrapped now, the you know, fuel, which is, of course, people need to fill their tank, to use their car. And what we're talking here about a population which is at work, but I think probably a kind of working poor, you know, people who need their car to commute, they take their car to commute and go to work. They don't use their car for leisure because they want to, because they need it. So I think for them it makes a difference whether, you know, fuel is going to be going to cost a little bit more because they're working poor. They just struggle to make ends meet. They are mostly on minimum wage. So we're talking about a kind of lower middle class in general who's been struggling, you know, to pay the bills, to pay fuel, to pay who hardly goes on holiday, and no leisure. Are very anxious about their future and also the future of their children. That's really the kind of population. And on top of that, there's the realization that the sort of the gap between rich and poor has been widening very much. And I think Macron, and you're right in saying that the tag of president of the rich is really stuck to him now. And it's the last president who had that tag was Nicolas Sarkozy, a previous conservative French president. And I think once you've got that tag stuck to you in France, it's very difficult for you really to get back in the game. So I think that's a really very much for Macron. So it's really what is very interesting. It started off as really a rebellion against that taxation on fuel, which you might say could be a bit of a sort of a bit middle of the road, even a right-wing type of protest. You know, if you don't want to pay tax. But I think what's very interesting, and since then, and we are now in week four of that protest, I think the debate has moved on to other issues. And the issues are really very much about cost of life, poverty, minimum wage, pay freeze, state of the public services in France. You know, it's all about that. And it's clearly no longer, if you like, a kind of typical sort of rebellion of people who don't want to pay taxes or simply who are sort of against migrants. By the way, there's been no talks about migration, about too many foreigners in France and so on and so forth, which has been, you know, a sort of a big topic in France and Europe over the past month. It's not on the agenda. The agenda is that we're getting poor. We're getting poorer and poorer. The rich are getting richer and richer. And this president is doing nothing for us. So it's totally unfair. That's why. That's really the key of that protest and why we've got now such strong opposition to Macron's policies.
And again, I'm speaking with Philippe Mallier, a professor of French and European politics at the University College of London. He's an expert on the French Socialist Party, French politics, and European social democracy. And we're talking about the ongoing riots in France by the Yellow Vest movement, and which is very much a populist uprising against a president, Macron, who's seen as being remote and elitist. And by the way, Philippe, he's had to reverse himself on both on the tax on the fuel and on the repealing the tax on the super rich. So he's not looking very strong in terms of a leader. My sense is that the real winners at the end of the day are going to be the far right in France. What do you think?
Maybe, because yes, probably in the end, you know, let's not forget that the Yellow Vest are not a political movement, let alone a party. Interestingly, there was a sort of hypothetical poll run over the weekend showing that were there to be a party or an organization running for the next European election, which is to take place next spring, they would get 13% of the share of the vote, and it would be ahead of, for instance, the radical left Jean-Luc Mélenchon, which is really, really something. The Le Pen's party, formerly known as the National Front, now the National Rally, would also lose a lot of votes. So I think it seems that they would be able, hypothetically, to appeal to both the far right and the radical left. But of course, we're not there yet. It seems to me that, yes, indeed, let's assume that at some point the sort of protests will calm down and disappear. But then probably, yes, it could be that the far right is there really to sort of get the vote. But again, what is really difficult to understand and what really is the originality of the movement is that it's neither left nor right. And clearly what is really at the heart of the movement is a kind of strong, I would say, defiance with regards to any form of political organization. They don't want to delegate their power to any representatives. You know, there have been talks about we should have representatives, and each time there was an attempt to nominate, to appoint so-called spokespeople, others would come, you know, others amongst the yellow vests would come forward and say, well, we do not recognize those people. You know, we must stay equal. There's no representatives. It's also, so in a sense, it's also a kind of indirectly a major critique of any form of democratic representation. You know, normally our societies rely on that. You know, people, citizens, elect representatives. And they seem really to go really completely against that. They don't want to have any delegates, any representatives, and also they don't want any political parties left and right within the movement. You know, it should remain, you know, a movement which is run by ordinary folks. So that is really new, because normally what happens, you know, typically in France, you know, a protest, a major protest would be organized, run by the unions, and later on the political parties would join in, or if not, at the very least, parties and unions would catch up afterward. But not this case. You know, parties, left and right, which so far have tried to catch up, you know, on the movement, were really dismissed. A number of MPs, notably on the left, have tried that. They were dismissed. They don't want any representatives, you know, any if you like, professional politicians to take part or represent them. So this is where the originality also, that creates a great uncertainty, if you like, for the future. Because if these people, again, we don't have any qualitative survey or polls, really, to tell us exactly who are these people. But I suspect many of them abstain. They don't vote in general. So they're neither left nor right. And it's really kind of very disenfranchised electorate who clearly no longer believes in traditional politics, no longer takes part in elections. Those are those people. They're not, again, the poorest in the population. They're working poor, so they are still, if you like, socialized enough to be part of the national community. But politically, they really stopped believing in sort of traditional party politics.
Well, Philippe Mallier, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're very welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Philippe Mallier, who's a professor of French and European politics at the University College of London. His main publications are about the French Socialist Party, French politics, and European social democracy. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back speaking about the Wahhabi Code, how the Saudis spread extremism globally.
I've been waiting for years to buy a brand new Cadillac. But now that I've got one, gotta send it right back. I can't afford that gas for my brand new limousine.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now from Indonesia is Terence Ward, an author and documentary producer who grew up in Saudi Arabia. He serves as international trustee for the World Conference of Religions for Peace and is a member of the Middle Eastern Institute in Rome. And his latest book just out is The Wahhabi Code, How the Saudis Spread Extremism Globally. And he had a recent op-ed in the Los Angeles Times, Saudi Arabia's Other Big Export. Welcome to Background Briefing, Terence Ward.
Thank you, Ian.
And it seems as though Donald Trump, who took an extraordinary position in defending Mohammed bin Salman and against all of the evidence that the CIA and others had provided, that the Turks, the rest of the world, accepts the obvious that Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, was the author of this hideous and gruesome assassination in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul of the Washington Post reporter Jamal Khashoggi. However, now there's a bit of blowback coming from the Senate, from Lindsey Graham and other key Republicans who simply don't want to defy logic and reality. From your position of having grown up in Saudi Arabia and written about the Wahhabi religious influence around the world, which is spread by the Saudi government and financed by their oil exports, do you think Trump has gotten away with it, with this rather brazen position he's taken?
You know, Ian, one can't be certain of anything these days, as you well know. But I would think that when this is the one issue that has united Republican and Democratic senators in a very divided Congress, in a very partisan Congress, this should tell us something. The many Republican senators, as Lindsey Graham said, there isn't a smoking gun, there's a smoking bone saw. Many of those Republican senators feel personally betrayed, which I think is rather telling for our listeners, that they believe a breach has taken place. And I think this red line is not going to remain unchecked. And I think that this may be the one issue where perhaps the president finds himself with rebellious Republicans who will make arguments that America stands for more than just a supply of oil or a few jobs. There are some principles that are important to adhere to, and this kind of brazen, as you said, a very hideous, grisly murder on a journalist has to be explored, and ultimately guilt has to be assessed. If you have a president who ignores the assessment of his intelligence, the entire intelligence apparatus, that's perhaps a grave thing. And I think the senators are all going to press this issue forward to make sure that there are repercussions.
Well, the amazing thing, that, and frankly, I don't know why Trump has not been challenged on this, is that obviously, I mean, at one point Trump said about the assassination that it was a bad concept. He was almost implying,
right,
I would have done it better, that they screwed it up. It was a terrible cover-up. So he's been really disgraceful in the way that he's framed it and apparently the way that he sees it, because there's a great deal of suspicion that he has personal, his family and Jared Kushner have financial arrangements with MBS. But the one thing that he puts out there all the time, which doesn't get sufficiently challenged, is he keeps saying, talking about U.S.-Saudi relations, how important they are. U.S.-Saudi relations aren't the same as the Trump family relations with MBS. In other words, there are plenty of other Saudis that we could be dealing with, many of them, by the way, under house arrest by MBS, including Mohammed bin Nayef, who originally was the Crown Prince and who was backed by the Washington establishment until Trump decided to promote MBS. So Trump really put this guy in power, did he not, or at least helped put MBS in power?
There are many, many who would argue that's the case, or at least the green light was given. The relationship between his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and MBS is meant to be very tight on a WhatsApp communication basis, quite freely chatting back and forth, which has alarmed many in the intelligence community because, of course, that's not protocol in the national security status. I think what has alarmed everyone is that the amount of press, of good press, of wonderful sort of PR that was built up during MBS's visit to America, meeting with the titans of Wall Street, of the great masters of Hollywood, the gurus of Silicon Valley, I think that was an extraordinary charm offensive, and everybody was very hopeful. But I think that one of the problems in assessing all of that power and all that goodwill was, shall we say, that perhaps any sense of limits were lost. And I think this is what has made people like Lindsey Graham and others, Senator Corker, stand up and say, I'm sorry, we've reached the limit. We have to deal with this issue. Of course, there. Who knows what promises have been made personally to the families back and forth. One can't be sure of that. But there are a number of senators who are saying, look, this young prince of the age of 33 has other behaviors that we've seen, the reckless war in Yemen that has led to 14, I mean, there are different numbers, 6 to 8 to 14 million people on the verge of starvation. The kidnapping of the Lebanese prime minister and holding him hostage. And also remember the break with Qatar and speaking about blockading the island, sealing it off, or actually creating an island, digging a trench around the island. These were acts that I think, say 6 months ago, everybody was rather willing to ignore. Now they, along with the Khashoggi incident and affair, they seem to be a repetitive pattern. And I think many of the senators are holding on to that. They want to make Yemen and halting the war in Yemen and ending the U.S. Supplies to Saudi Arabia, military aid to Saudi Arabia, as a bargaining chip to actually change this this reckless behavior that that they feel is very dangerous. So regardless of what personal relationship that the Trump may have had, perhaps that gave out the wrong signal, that he was beyond immunity, that he was simply untouchable. And now I think the Saudi royal family, as you said, are really questioning what does this mean, and perhaps they weren't untouchable, that that red line has been crossed. And there is discussions that within the family they are really grappling with next steps, and MBS is obviously, his role is a big key to all of this.
And again, I'm speaking with Terence Ward, who is an author and documentary producer who grew up in Saudi Arabia and serves as international trustee for the World Conference of Religions and Peace and is a member of the Middle Eastern Institute in Rome. And his latest book just out is The Wahhabi Code, How the Saudis Spread Extremism Globally. And he has a recent op-ed at the Los Angeles Times, Saudi Arabia's Other Big Export. The big export that you are talking about, Terence Ward, is essentially violence in the name of religion. Takfir is the term. It's a religious exemption that this extreme sect of Islam, Wahhabism, gives or offers, religious sanction to murder non-believers. And this, more often than not, in fact, almost 90%, I guess, plus of the victims of this Saudi-generated religious extremism are fellow Muslims. And the greatest number of victims of Saudi Wahhabism seem to be the Sufis in Pakistan, mm-hmm. the Swat Valley. I just saw an extraordinary documentary that was made by a Syrian who was embedded with a Wahhabi Syrian extremist who was a bomb maker who did suicide bombings or rigged cars to blow up, etc. And it's called Our Fathers and Sons. And you really get an insight into the mind of these Takfiris. And one of the prefaces to explaining who this guy was and how his background in this part of Syria in Idlib province was that the whole village used to be Sufi. Until the Wahhabis came in and drove them out. And that's happening all across the Middle East and around the world. So just put a perspective on it for us, because I think your book's very important in exposing the Saudi double game, where they publicly deny involvement with this kind of violence at the same time they turn a blind eye and, more often than not, aid and abet this violence?
Well, let's put the... We can frame it by simply saying that the Wahhabi doctrine, which was promulgated by Muhammad Abdul Wahhab, is only 250 years old. It's an extremely young doctrine that entered into Islam in the center of Arabia. And it's a very severe, a very ultra-conservative, a Puritan expression of Islam. And it, through quirk of history, became then the official religion of Saudi Arabia. But it also, and I think this is to your point, has become the core ideology for a number of international terror groups. In other words, if I was to tell you that the Islamic State, when they began publishing, published 7 out of their first 12 books were the teachings of Abdul Wahhab. When they conquered towns and burnt the school books, they didn't replace them with other secular school books. They replaced them with Saudi school curriculum. When the magistrates were ruling in courts, the bulk of them were Saudi born, and many of the jihadis were from Saudi Arabia. Now, nobody has written extensively about this, but we all know from people like Robert Fisk, Patrick Cockburn, many journalists have noted this, but few have said that actually the ISIS ideology and ISIS leaders have claimed to be better Wahhabis than the Saudis themselves. Now, to put it in framework, this Puritan faith embeds this idea of takfir, this idea that you can condemn, that you can excommunicate even another Muslim, is solely a Wahhabi concept. It doesn't exist in Islam, this idea of being able to excommunicate another Muslim and then have a sanction to kill. This is what has been spread, but this weaponized Wahhabism has been spread through the madrasas in Western Pakistan that ultimately ended up educating the students, what they call Taliban, meaning simply students in Arabic. But they were inculcated with this very severe, austere, Puritan view. But not only that, In Iraq, the same thing happened when some of Saddam's soldiers found themselves imprisoned with other jihadis who spoke about this new way of seeing the world. And as you said, when you use that example of Sufis converting over into the jihadis, it became a very attractive way of dealing with their Shia so-called enemies, or the enemies of the Alawites. It helped to fuel the sectarian violence that's exploded across Syria. And one of the great problems is when this weaponized Wahhabism goes into the world, how can it be controlled? How can it be dealt with? And quite frankly, this is one of the great problems. Almost any Muslim you talk to, Ian, will tell you with great pain in their hearts that they can't believe what has happened to their faith. They can't believe that so many Muslims are held to blame for what has taken place. And they say, this has nothing to do with our Islam. This is a complete deviant doctrine that has somehow been weaponized, and we are held to blame. Very little has been written on the Wahhabi on the Wahhabi creed. And it's very important to understand that in 1924, the Wahhabis seized Mecca. Now, before then, for centuries, it was the center of the universe, of the Sufi universe. Pilgrims came from Bukhara. They would find the shrine of their Bukhara saint or their teacher who had passed away in Mecca, and they would all gather there. They would find those who spoke their own language. And the same happened with Javanese pilgrims. The same happened with African pilgrims. It was a place where you would have heard drumming, where you would have heard those celebrating their victories. It was an alive body of the entire Islamic world. When the Hashemite family, who had ruled this city as the guardians of Mecca, when the end of this First World War came about, the British understood that there were oil reserves in Arabia, and they removed support of the Sharifs of Mecca, who were cosmopolitan. The Sharif of Mecca hoped to create an Arab kingdom with a bicameral parliament, House of Commons, House of Lords, a bit like the UK. He read the Financial Times. Instead, the British chose to back the Saud family and their Bedouin warriors who were riding out of Central Arabia. When Mecca was seized, then these Puritan Bedouins who rode in with this ultra-conservative creed of Wahhabism, they imposed that doctrine, their doctrine, on the sacred city of the Kaaba, the city of the Prophet, and in a strange way on the larger Islamic world. And that is how it has spread to so many different countries. There's a word called Dawa Wahhabiya, and it means the Wahhabi mission. And there have been tens of billions of dollars that have been invested in creating madrasas, in sending imams out to different parts of the world to promulgate this message.
In the last couple of minutes here, though, I wanted to tie that to the House of Saud, to the royal family, because there's a compact between the Wahhabis there. In fact, all of this money that goes into these madrasas comes directly from the Al Sauds, who control the oil wealth, and they're funding this propagation of this austere and reactionary form of Islam that has inspired so much violence around the world. And as you point out in your book, it's also changing Europe, because if you look at what the Islamic State did and all of the refugees coming out of Syria and Iraq ending up in Europe, we all know what a destabilizing impact that has had. So the compact is basically, you let us rule, take all the oil wealth in this kind of medieval family kingdom that we have, where we have an absolute monarchy, and where there's no vestige of any kind of representation for the ordinary people. But the Wahhabism, that's what keeps people passive. If in this abortion debate we have here in the United States, the point that women make is that we don't want the government controlling our bodies. Well, in Saudi Arabia, the government controls your body 100% via the Wahhabis. Isn't that the compact? In other words, they offer to the Al Sauds a passive, controlled population that accepts this outrageous idea that this young prince can spend billions of dollars on chateaus in France and on a fake Leonardo da Vinci and on $500 million yachts, while you have starvation in Saudi Arabia, poverty, and of course, as you pointed out earlier, half of the population of Yemen is facing starvation.
Well, the core of the issue really lies in the pact that Abdul Wahhab made with the first Saud ruler, and that pact stands today. I mean, the point is that the Saudi rulers and the Saud family are Wahhabis, and yes, the pact was based on political allegiance to the Saud ruler, in return for the creed or the doctrine being the official doctrine of the state. So that is what you have. You have a religious theocracy that's also a monarchy. And there is very little room for criticism, very little room for dissent, as we've seen. I mean, the Khashoggi case is a very dramatic case in point. But there's something also quite dramatic in that very few people ever speak of, which is the silence that the money and the PR firms, the American PR firms that have been purchased by the Saudi funds, the silence that has remained for so many years about the very nature of this of this creed and this mission going into the world. And again, as we've seen with what happened in Syria, as we saw what happened in Brussels, as we saw what happened in Paris, this database run by Professor Leif Winner at the King's College in London, it's called the Global Terrorism Database, and he cites that more than 94% of the deaths caused by Islamic terrorism since 2001 were perpetrated by Islamic State, Al-Qaeda, and other Sunni jihadists. Now, he also said almost every terrorist attack in the West has had some connection to Saudi Arabia. Now, let me repeat that. He concluded that almost every attack in the West has had some connection to Saudi Arabia. Virtually none has been linked to Iran. And most people who know the Middle East will tell you the fear that many people have is that there's a great buildup towards another war, a third war, this time against Iran. And yet, strangely enough, what I just read, the words of Leif Winner, actually these were quoted from Fareed Zakaria, that all these terrorist attacks have had some connection to Saudi Arabia. And my question is, how can it be that the intelligence community, that the editorial community of journalists, that that all those concerned about the security issue, and there's so many people concerned about it, never speak to this truth?
Right.
And I simply wrote the book because I have a host of Muslim friends who are agonized about this fact. I have a host of other friends that have asked me questions about it. And when I was commissioned the book, it was done as an act of love for them and for their faith and for what they see as their faith literally being taken hostage. And they don't feel comfortable speaking out about it because they see a president that doesn't have the courage to speak the truth.
Well, he's incapable of speaking the truth. He's a very sick and disgraceful person.
Well, I totally agree.
And we have a terrible problem here in this country. But just in closing,
exactly,
it's obvious that the distortion of Islam by the Wahhabis and the export of this reactionary, austere, anti-Western version of Islam that has, as you point out, has nothing to do with the religion itself.
No.
The only beneficiaries are the Saudi royal family, Western oil companies, and arms dealers.
And, you know, in closing, I'd just like to say that if one of the conclusions I have in my book was if people can learn to simply understand and speak and explore what Wahhabism is, then perhaps they would exonerate 1.5 billion Muslims and followers of Islam from all the accusations that's been taking place. And that lies at the heart of the matter. We need to explore this, we need to understand it, and we need to actually have a very clear and sober look at what the roots are of the ideology and what has happened when it's been weaponized. And I think that the Muslim communities around the world would breathe an enormous sigh of relief if we could do our due diligence and ask ourselves these questions and perhaps even debate the so-called strategic partnership with the Saudis in the long term.
So given that you have just explained the extraordinary importance of exposing the Wahhabi creed, the Dawah Wahhabiyya, and how it's been so destructive around the world, and yet the White House and the Trump administration insists that Saudis are our greatest allies. And as you pointed out, there is a war with Iran brewing. There's also the so-called Middle East peace plan that Jared Kushner has that hinges on MBS, the idea that you have this psychotic little punk who is out of control and has total impunity and could murder a Washington Post correspondent in such a gruesome way and order his minions, as the CIA has intercepted, saying, bring me the head of the dog. That's where Khashoggi's head ended up. It ended up probably on MBS's desk, just as Stalin is supposed to have ended up with Hitler's skull on his desk. I mean, we're dealing with some really disgraceful people, and yet the Saudis have found our weak spot, which is money. America operates on money. Washington operates on money. That's the sick arrangement, isn't it? They go around destroying the world, creating mayhem, and they buy off Washington.
I think you've come to the right conclusion. And buying off simply means there's silence. And in that silence, they get a free pass. And when people are given free passes, you can draw your own conclusions. There was a great New York Times article written a few years ago called Arsonists and Firefighters. And they were describing the Saudi relationship. On the one hand, you had private funders from Saudi Arabia all excited about the role of ISIS in combating the Shia president or the Alawite president, Hafez al-Assad. Terribly excited. And then all of a sudden, they started to worry about those fighters coming home and then bringing the war home. So this idea that both the ideology is what feeds the jihadis, and at the same time, they happen to be our allies in fighting jihadis while the ideology has fed them. I mean, this to me is a great paradox. And believe me, a lot of people security community and in politics and diplomacy, they know this truth. No one speaks about it because it's so embarrassing. Also because America has been complicit. And Americans have both funded, originally Bin Laden's exercise over in Afghanistan. They also, there were American guns and American weaponry and American, those white Toyota trucks that ended up in the hands of ISIS. That was all funded as well through the American efforts to destabilize Assad's regime. So, you know, this kind of nexus of our intelligence people and our military adventurers overseas, and both using the Saudis as jihadis, but then being shocked when sometimes the guns are turned against us or against European or Parisian diners sitting in Paris when all those ISIS Wahhabi jihadis went through the streets, massacring so many people on that Friday the 13th night in November of 2015. We have to understand there is a connection, and I think the sooner we understand there's a connection, the sooner we can start talking openly about the problem. But you know, we have a president who claims to be against terrorism. We have Senate that has absolutely driven to, secure our borders. And yet at the same time, you have this irony where the one country where, as I just read, had a connection to so many different acts is one that escaped the so-called ban. The absurdities keep sort of adding up, Ian.
Well, of course. And then, of course, the crowning irony is that you've got this murderous little punk who is being given a free pass by Donald Trump when the whole world sees that he is guilty. And that how could you possibly have a relationship with a country led by such a psychotic murderer who has a sense of total impunity?
And are Americans ready to engage in a third war in the Middle East, this time against Iran, to support this gentleman and his reckless behavior. I mean, is this really where we want to go? Do we want to spend another $1 trillion with all of our economy, or at least our infrastructure in tatters, education system in tatters? Do we want to really go down that path of adventurism simply because a 32-year-old man has turned and pointed to the country across the Gulf and says, you know, they must be attacked? I would suggest that there's a reason why President Obama created that nuclear agreement with Iran.
Right.
I think with two countries, rival adversaries like this, you could argue unreliable partners, he probably decided best to remove nuclear issue from the table completely.
Right. Well,
and that's why the deal was done with Iran. But
Terrence
Ian, you know what they want to do now? They want to give, there's debate to give the Saudis nuclear weapons or nuclear technology, which of course would lead to nuclear
well,
weapons.
They could already get a bomb from the Pakistanis if they wanted. Again,
of course they could.
Again, I'm speaking with Terrence Ward, the author, documentary producer, who grew up in Saudi Arabia. He's the author of the brand new book, Just Out, The Wahhabi Code, How the Saudis Spread Extremism Globally. Just in closing, I think you've made a very strong case why this book is important and why it's important for Americans and people in the West to understand the source of so much of the agony and violence in this world, and how it's all being perpetrated in the name of religion. We already, obviously in history, we've had the Crusades. Christians have been guilty of this same kind of extremism. And even more recently in Northern Ireland, we've had religious wars.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not without. And when you mentioned how the Saudis destabilized it, Syria, of course, there was a popular uprising known as the Arab Spring, and it happened in Syria as well.
Mm-hmm.
The people wanted to get rid of that mafia family, the Assad mm-hmm. family. But the Saudis essentially hijacked that popular revolt and turned Syria into a graveyard, along with the complicity of the Assad. So this is the mm-hmm. the world we're in, and as you point out in your book, Europe has been destabilized as a result
yeah.
of this. So you can
mm-hmm.
trace the culpability for why Poland has turned to the right, why Hungary's turned to the right, and why mm-hmm. France is likely to turn to the right. We see the demonstrations
exactly.
today. This is what's going on.
I'll tell you, the entire affair began when my 16-year-old niece asked me a question. What's happening in the Middle East after the Paris massacre? She asked me this question. And when I told her, grab your friends and let's have a conversation in about, say, a week. And I was about to enter the room when my brother-in-law called me up and said, no, there'll be a few more people there. Now, it's a big family archive. And I said, okay, well, that'll be fine. When I entered the room, Ian, there were 75 people there. There were grandmothers, grandfathers, uncles, aunts, brothers, cousins, sisters, and then my 16-year-old niece and her three friends. And at that moment, I realized nobody had a clue of what was happening. And what we have to understand is, since 9/11, it's now, what are we looking at, 17 years or 16 years? We now have been faced with this great mystery. What is happening in the Middle East? Why has it touched us? How did security, how did we enter a world where we're going to be monitored from the moment we're born until the day we die by security cameras, by security apparatus? It all comes back to this. Now, doesn't it make sense that citizens should understand why this has happened? What are the roots? And have we been lied to? You could argue, yes. Have truths been hidden from us? Yes. Have they been self-serving so that petroleum would flow? Yes. Have we protected perhaps a family that needed, say, a different treatment? Perhaps. Do we need to reassess where all of this ideology that created, because remember, there were 15 out of 19 hijackers were from Saudi Arabia that flew into those towers. How is it possible that we know less now than we knew in 2001? And if we know less now, it really behooves us to try and get some simple information. I tried to write the book very accessibly. I have no axe to grind. I have no anger in this. I wanted to try and heal the worlds of Muslim friends who find themselves always accused for things they had nothing to do with and that are very far from their religion. So that's why I put these words down, through affection for them. And in the book, I also cite the Sufi faith. I cite the Sufi followers. I cite the Shia. I cite the larger Sunni communities. It is not simply about the Wahhabis. In other words, this vast constellation of Islam is not all, it doesn't all boil down to the small, little, fundamentalist creed that was born in Central Arabia. The constellations of Islam are vast and diverse as the constellations of Christianity. We have to understand that. These are not our enemies. But there are some people who have weaponized certain elements, and we have to understand the differences. 1.5 billion people can be exonerated. They have nothing to do with this. It's far deeper. And so that's why I wrote the book, and that's why I put this word out.
Well, Terence Ward, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Terence Ward, who's an author and documentary producer who grew up in Saudi Arabia and serves as the international trustee for the World Conference of Religions and Peace and is a member of the Middle East Institute in Rome. And his latest book just out is The Wahhabi Code, How the Saudis Spread Extremism Globally. And he had a recent op-ed at the Los Angeles Times, Saudi Arabia's Other Big Export. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now. We'll be right back.